agriculture for about 15 years now. Two books really changed the way I cover agriculture. The Worst Hard Time by Timothy Egan, which was really the backbone for Ken Burns' documentary on the Dust Bowl. And then the book Dirt by David Montgomery, which is about the soil erosion and its effect on society over time. Those two books really kind of made me change and rethink how I cover agriculture. So I've been to a lot of USDA, NRCS presentations on water quality and soil and erosion issues and the rain simulations. As I saw on the SEJ listserv, the back and forths on the Toledo algae issues and water quality and the effects of agriculture, and I saw maybe a few misperceptions, I think, on different cropping practices and their effects on water runoff. I wanted to have one of these NRCS or conservation rain simulation tests to kind of demonstrate a little bit on different cropping and soil practices and their impacts on water runoff. So today with me, and I'm going to use my emailed version of BIOS here, have Shannon Phillips, who is the director of the Water Quality Division for the Oklahoma Conservation Commission. I got that right? And please note, if you're taking notes, Shannon's first name, real quick, one in there in the middle. Just want to point that
out.
Just
to be difficult.
So she has a bachelor's degree in biology from Kansas State University and a master's in zoology from Oklahoma State, focusing on the impacts of nutrients in lakes. She's been working in water quality protection programs in Oklahoma for about 20 years now. Her agency is the lead agency for non-point source pollution. Most of the Oklahoma Conservation Commission's work focuses on collaboration with conservation districts to help agricultural producers protect water quality and improve soil health. Shannon lives in Oklahoma City with her husband John and her son Cooper. Her family farm is in Coffee County, Kansas, near the town of Waverly. Then we have Clay Pope. Clay helped me out on the tour we had the other day. Clay's a farmer and rancher. He served in the Oklahoma House of Representatives from 94 to 2004, and he was vice chairman of the House Agriculture Committee during that time. He then became executive director of the Oklahoma Association of Conservation Districts from 2004 to 2014. Clay has received numerous awards from Farm Bureau, Oklahoma Cattlemen's, Farmers Union, a broad array of awards. He was named in 2005 as a graduate of distinction from the College of Agriculture, Oklahoma State University. I guess we don't talk to him much about OU, apparently.
No, we don't.
We bring that up with his wife, who's an OU grad. So, and he also won an award for his work with Ken Burns on that documentary, The Dust Bowl. Right now, Clay has a consulting business he formed with his wife that focuses on natural resources protection. Then we have Greg Scott.
Where is he based from?
Here, in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma City? Yeah.
Well, no, a little town called Loyal, about 70 miles northwest of L-O-Y-A-L.
Thank you.
You bet.
And then we have Greg Scott. He and his wife, Becky, have a small cattle operation in Lincoln County, Oklahoma. Trying to reclaim land that was once a cotton farm, from what I understand. They have a cow-calf system and experiment with different grazing systems. He's a soil scientist with the Oklahoma Conservation Commission and primarily involved with a broad range of soil health issues, including no-till farming, cover crops, and ecosystem health. He serves as director, I didn't realize you were director of No-Till in the Plains, and he has led educational organizations, which No-Till in the Plains is a big agricultural organization in Kansas. Obviously, the name focuses on no-till throughout the plains and cover cropping practices. Greg is a graduate of Oklahoma State University with a degree in soil science and has a master's degree in environmental science. He was born and raised in Oklahoma City, but decided to escape. So there we go. And with that, we'll go ahead and we're going to take our presentation.
The city now?
What's your city now?
My city is Tryon.
Spell it?
T-R-Y-O-N.
Thank you, much.
Try on some shoes.
But it is Oklahoma.
Yes.
Thank you much.
All right, so we can either go out the back and swing around that way, or we can come on through this door right here, and we'll head on out to the presentation. presentation, and Greg will be really taking over from there.
I guess everybody can hear me okay. They probably can hear me okay in there. I hope, anyway, the microphone's working right. As mentioned, I'm Clay Pope. I'm a natural resource consultant here in Oklahoma, but one of the big things I'm doing right now in partnership with my wife, who, as was mentioned earlier, is a graduate of another university from where I graduated from. I graduated from Oklahoma State. She's from a school that shall not be named that we're a little closer to here today, but she and I both work as consultants, but primary work we're doing right now is through NRCS and ARS with the Southern Plains Climate Hub. We helped to work to facilitate the work of the hub, and that's one of the things that we wanted to come and talk about today. What you're going to be seeing here in a little bit is a demonstration on how different land management practices affect the ecosystem. Because when you get right down to it, in this part of the world, when we're looking at all of these issues that we have challenges with, everything from non-point source pollution to water supply, wildlife habitat, climate change, just trying to be able to make sure that we have enough food and fiber to feed and clothe 9 billion people by mid-century, quite frankly, the secret's in the soil. And I think that's one of the things that we've lost as we've looked at production agriculture over especially the course of the 20th century. But I think when you're looking at some of these challenges that we are dealing with, how do we make sure that we protect our natural resource base? How can we help agriculture producers, both farmers and ranchers, to adapt to the weather variability, the extremes that climate change exacerbates? And hell, we've always had crazy weather in this part of the world. You know, Will Rogers said, if you don't like the weather in Oklahoma, just wait a minute, it'll change. And all climate change really means for our part of the world is that that weather's just going to get crazier, going to get shot on steroids, basically, and it's going to become more variable. And so what we have today is to talk a little bit about some of the tools that we have that can help improve the health of the soil, help maintain productivity, help agriculture producers' bottom lines, while also doing things to help address those issues. So with that, I'm going to be quiet. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Greg Scott to run our rainfall simulator and talk a little bit more about what we're doing today. Greg?
All right. Thank you, Clay. I like to tell people that I spent the first 35 years working to get ready to learn what we've learned in the last five. Science and agriculture is undergoing dramatic changes, and this first little demonstration simply is to underline and highlight the importance and the uniqueness and the limited number of acres that we have for cropland agriculture. How many acres of cropland do you think there is for each person in the world, to support each person in the world? Robert, would you help me? I just need you to hold the mic. So, about 3/4 of Earth is water, right? About 6 billion people live on Earth. So I'm going to take my apple and I'm going to...
7.3.
Okay. Well, the numbers change even as we speak. 3/4 of Earth is water. 1/4 of Earth is land area. Are people evenly distributed over that land area? They are not. 1/2 of the land area on Earth doesn't even support inhabitants. High desert, tundra, ice, mountainous. There's 1/2 a land area where people don't even live. That leaves me 1/8 of the Earth's surface. How much of this is farmland? I'm going to take my 1/8 of an apple, and cut it in half and give me a 1/16. I'm going to take that 1/16 of an apple and cut it. And I have a 32nd or 3% of Earth's surface that has land that is arable that can grow crops. It's about 10% of the land area, but about 3% of Earth's surface is arable. When you do the math, that amounts to about 1/4 of an acre per person of cropland on a worldwide basis. That area of cropland decreases daily as population increases and as land degrades and as we convert good farmland into other uses, for instance, a parking lot. 1/4 of an acre is about 100 by 100 square feet. That's a very small land area to provide food, feed, fiber, and energy to Earth's population. And Clay mentioned that he might have made available a little document called Conquest of the Land over 6,000 years. It's in print. You can get a PDF of it. But Dr. Loudermilk made the point, and I'll elaborate a little bit, social stability, stability of civilizations, and national stability ultimately depends on food security. That's the most important factor in stability of nations. And as our cropland area decreases dramatically year after year, we get closer and closer to worldwide instability in food security. My graph looks like an X. Population increases, cropland area per person decreases. Somewhere that intersection gives us a crisis. And throughout the course of human history, that crisis has occurred quite often, if we know our history. So let me set that down and introduce to you a little bit of what we see as the real answer for stability in agriculture and sustainability. This demonstration is a rainfall simulator. We're going to make it rain about an inch and a half, a good, fast Oklahoma rain. In fact, I forgot my rain gauge. These pans are slotted. They're slotted so that if we catch any water when it rains and it gets into the soil and it gets through that surface and we catch it in the subsoil, that is water that we have caught and can use for beneficial use. And it's going to flow through the pans and get caught in our buckets in the back. Water that runs off the surface as erosion is water that we get and we lose, and we lose the resource that comes with it. This first, two of these pans are actually from my house. This first pan is from a floodplain forest site. It's only about 20 feet from a stream. We raise walnut trees on it. It actually is not grazed. This next pan, bare ground, is actually compacted to simulate a construction site. This middle pan is conventional tillage soil, just like you would go out and see somebody tilling a farm, go over it with a disc. We were all raised to think that this is what we have to do to prepare ground to grow crops. That fourth pan there is a pasture of mixed grass and legumes that used to be a cotton field at my house. We put it back to permanent vegetation about 8 years ago. It's slowly healing up. And finally on the end is an interesting pan from a producer at Coyle, Oklahoma, that produces crops on a year-round basis. But it has not been tilled or plowed in 17 years. This producer follows a harvest with planting. And right now you can see that he's planted winter wheat. We go out into the fields and we cut a slab of this soil, set it in the pan, and when you look at that surface, you can see that it's armored by stuff that's actually the residue from previous crops. There's canola, wheat, grain sorghum. All that residue from those previous crops is armoring that surface and protecting that surface and allowing that soil to heal. The short story, if you don't hear anything else we say today, the short story is that any management that mimics nature will be successful. Anytime I work with natural processes, I will tend to be successful. So let's start the rain, and we'll see what we get. Now, while that does its thing, I want to get your attention to this little demonstration. It's only been about 20 years ago that some ladies with the Agricultural Research Service discovered a molecule in the soil, a protein, and in 1995, the first paper on that protein was titled, "A Unique Protein from the Soil." We don't know where it comes from, we don't know what it does, but they later discovered that this protein was a byproduct of the growth of a fungus in the soil, and as that fungus grows and leaves behind that sheath, that sticky protein begins to rebuild the soil structure. It starts to help that soil bind together and build an environment that bacteria and other fungus and roots, microorganisms, can live in. plowing kills that life, and when you kill that fungus and that protein degrades, we end up with soils that essentially have a structure that we built with a tillage tool. It's a clod. And these two little chunks of soil are from that field in the middle of that pan. And when I drop them in my water, you can see that as the water rushes in that clod, there's nothing to bind the soil together. It starts to fall apart. The water explodes that structure. And it has no strength. And these fields, this is a typical representation for any field that's in tillage agriculture. This clod on the left is from a field that's been in no-till agriculture for an unknown number of years. It has enough of this protein and a large amount of organic matter that it regulates water movement into and out of that structural component, and you have strength, and yet you're like a sponge, but you have strength. These fields typically have high runoff. They lose a lot of sediment. You end up with dirty streams, dirty lakes, dirty rivers, and along with that soil, as it dislodges and leaves the field, then I lose a resource and society gets sediment, nutrients, pollutants, and a cost to clean that water and reuse it. I'll give this to Clay for a minute.
When I think one of the things that Greg said as we watched the demonstration here, I think that's so key is a term that deals with so many of the issues that we're talking about, and that's organic matter. You know, we don't think about the dirt as being a living, breathing ecosystem underneath our feet. But to be quite frank about it, we know more about the surface of the moon than we do the life underneath the soil. And if you think about the soil, one teaspoon of soil can contain more life forms in it than there are people walking on the face of the globe. And it's those bugs, bacteria, and fungus that work together to ensure that we have healthy growing crops and healthy grass on top of the soil. The trouble is our soil's sick. We've lost anywhere from 80 to 90% of the organic matter out of our soil since initial plow up. And it's that organic matter that feeds those bugs, bacteria, and fungus underneath the ground that help us more effectively grow crops. But also when you think about organic matter, the majority of organic matter is nothing but organic carbon. Carbon dioxide that's taken out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis and restored back to the soil. You know, a perfect example, Greg's been talking about no-till. No-till agriculture in Oklahoma, if you can convert from conventional till to no-till, on average you can sequester up to half a metric ton of carbon dioxide per acre per year. That's not including the amount of emissions that are avoided by converting from conventional tillage to no-till. And according to Oklahoma State University, the school I graduated from, the one not down here, but for my wife's benefit, I will point that out. According to Oklahoma State University, on average, to grow a wheat crop in Oklahoma, it takes 3 gallons of diesel less per acre per year under no-till than it does conventional till. So not only are you sequestering carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, you're also reducing the amount of emissions. You have avoided emissions because you're reducing the amount of diesel used to produce that crop. You know, when you think about, I said no-till wheat production, you think about grass, you can sequester as much as an eighth of a ton or even more in Oklahoma by doing better pasture management and doing things that restore the organic matter to the soil. But you're not only helping fighting climate change. Greg was talking about water quality. And I'd like to call up here Shannon Phillips really quick, because as we look at what we see in front of us as far as the runoff that's coming off these different practices type, I want to turn the microphone over to Shannon Phillips, because I've been talking about this as a way to help fight climate change. Better land management is also the best way to help agriculture producers to adapt to climate change, because you can also help hold on to more moisture in the soil. Greg talked about how we're going to hold on to every raindrop that we get. According to Kansas State, a 1% increase in organic matter in your soil can triple your soil's water holding capacity. That's as much as 25,000 gallons of additional water per acre per year for growing crops. that not only helps those crops, but it also helps put your water cycle back into balance. And it's controlling runoff, which is why I want Shannon to come up here and talk, because through these practices, Oklahoma has taken nearly 50 streams off the EPA impaired list. It's number two in the nation in the amount of streams that have been taken out, but more importantly, it's been done through in different ecosystems with different cropping systems, and it's one of the best water quality success stories in the country. With that, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Shannon, and Shannon, you might talk about how carbon sequestration ties into that too.
All right. Well, thank you, Clay. As Chris said, I work for the Oklahoma Conservation Commission, and the mission of the Conservation Commission is to conserve and protect the natural resources of Oklahoma. Now, we're an entirely non-regulatory agency, and so we have to do that through voluntary programs. That means that we're relying on people to make their own decisions about making changes in their management style, and to do that, we've got to educate them. And so Greg and his team work to educate producers about the principles of soil health and how those changes in management style can improve their operation. But there's another audience that we have to convince, and sometimes that's our funders, but it's also the rest of society about the value of these practices, because we are investing, we're investing U.S. tax dollars in these processes that encourage farmers to make these changes. So if we're going to invest tax dollars, we have to prove to people that those processes are working. And one of the best ways we can do that is by measuring and monitoring water quality that drains from these areas. So we like to say that a stream or a river or a lake is a reflection of its watershed. And that means that all those bodies of surface water drain from the land surface somewhere. And if you're draining through a system that mimics nature, like a mountain stream, that stream is obviously going to look a lot different than a stream that drains a parking lot or downtown Oklahoma City. So as Greg said earlier, we're trying to encourage producers to mimic natural systems, and then we're using water quality monitoring across the state to prove that that works. So we monitor over 250 small streams across the state. We look at the chemical state of the water, we look at the physical habitat that's there, and we look at the biological community. And what we found is that in a time period that coincides with the installation of these voluntary cost share practices that protect the farmer's bottom line and improve the sustainability on his operation, we're also improving water quality. We've seen streams that were impaired since the early 90s now are meeting water quality standards, and we're able to take them off the EPA 303D list. And as Clay said, those are streams that are all over Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, people might not realize this, we're one of the most ecologically diverse states in the nation. I think there's only really California and Texas that have the same or more ecological diversity than Oklahoma. And so whether these are arid streams or in extremely wet areas of the state, we're able to implement these voluntary conservation practices and improve water quality. We're improving streams that were impaired for too much sediment, too much bacteria, not enough oxygen, so all different causes of pollution. And what we're also seeing is that all of these streams are occurring in areas of the state that have a strong agriculture. We're not a very populous state. Most of our land ownership is in private land management, and most of that land management is row crop or cattle agriculture. So what we've seen is that we can have strong agricultural industry coincide with natural resource protection. And we're using water quality to do that. And as Clay said, there's only one state in the nation that has more success at solving water quality problems from non-point source pollution than Oklahoma. Anybody here from Washington State? Okay, well, you guys are awesome, but we're coming after you. Yeah, so again, one of the things that I'd like to highlight is that EPA funds and provides funding through many states through the Section 319 of the Clean Water Act. And the focus of that program is on non-point source pollution. One of the ways that program evaluates its success is how many streams were states able to delist from the 303D list. There's a website, there's a flyer that includes that. Please take an opportunity to look at some of the, because states, every state in the nation now has a success story highlighting how these voluntary programs are solving water quality problems. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Greg.
We'll take a minute to look at the results and talk about questions. I consider a healthy forest floor or a healthy rangeland to be my best case scenario for comparison. Like I say, at my house, this site is about 25 feet above a stream, about 50 feet away from the channel, under a canopy of walnut, hackberry, and elm. It's got a little bit of false crabgrass and Virginia wild rye and some seedlings. When it rains, we have already made the decision of how we're going to partition water in the environment, okay? We don't make that decision after it starts raining. This site took all of that rain and either stored it in the soil or sent it down into the subsoil. Subsoil is the safest place to store water. In Oklahoma, we need to keep it safe away from... No, I'm good. We want to keep it safe from wind and heat and sun. And what have I have made a decision at this site. All of the water that I get, I can use for beneficial use. I'm going to grow plants with it. Potentially, I may harvest walnuts. This water that gets in the subsoil is going to be partitioned partly to base flow. Base flow is the water that moves from a site back to the stream, feeds that stream throughout the year and gives us perennial flow. Part of it is going to feed an aquifer. I live on well water at home. I want my aquifer to be healthy. If I can get all of the water in the soil, I can use it for those beneficial purposes. And that also benefits society. Down here at the end in my no-till system, I harvested these two pans yesterday, fairly dry. The organic matter content of this soil is going to be somewhere around 4 to 5%. Figure 80,000 pounds per acre of organic matter. Look how much runoff I got. During the drought years, this producer never failed to harvest a crop. The reason that he harvested a crop is because this healthy field is more efficient at using the water he gets. He doesn't lose any to runoff. And because we've added insulation in the form of standing crop and crop residue, he doesn't lose much water to evaporation. One of the most difficult things to understand for us producers is that bare ground has an invisible loss of evaporation that's generally more than any crop is using. So I've got a little bit of water that got into the subsoil here. But because this was dry, that inch and a half or 2 inches of water is predominantly being held by this organic matter that's a part of the soil, that's the residue and the transformed organic chemicals from a lot of the roots and animals that live in this soil. Organic matter has a pretty long, gangly, cellulose, lignin kind of structure, a lot of surface area. Water in the soil only stays in the soil because it has a surface to bond to, and the surface tension can hold it against gravity. Soils with a lot of organic matter hold a lot of water. If I could raise the organic matter of my soil by 1% in the surface layer, I can add about 25,000 gallons of extra water holding capacity to that soil. Our pan, huh? Over 1 acre. The pan in the middle is essentially the same soil as the pan on the end. The organic matter has been destroyed by tillage, and it's less than one now. The other thing that's happened here is that when we quit tilling this soil, that underground fungal body reorganized and rebuilt itself. We're just now understanding that there's more beneficial microorganisms in the soil than there are disease-causing microorganisms. And these fungus bodies that build structure also colonize the crops that we grow. About 90% of the crops we grow rely on an underground ecosystem connection. And so when this fungus colonizes this wheat crop, in exchange for a little bit of sugar, the fungus brings water, phosphorus, zinc to that plant that the plant can't reach. In fact, if this underground ecosystem of fungus is established, when these plants germinate and that fungus colonizes that plant immediately has access to a larger volume of soil than it could hope for if it had to grow its own roots through all that volume of soil. And if we had a legume in this system, that same fungus would transfer nitrogen from the legume back to a grass and might transfer phosphorus and zinc from the grass back to the legume. So in a diverse plant system, there's more cooperation than there is competition. And in this cropping situation, he uses a rotation that includes corn, grain sorghum, wheat, cotton, canola, which is a mustard, and soybeans, to mimic nature by successively planting different crops that have different physiologies and different root systems and that support different parts of that underground ecosystem. In these healthy soils, there'll be about 5,000 pounds of little bitty livestock, from bacteria up to earthworms, that are actually supporting the plants that we need, that we rely on. And we're just now learning to understand how that underground system is important, and my plant diversity that I put on the surface can help that ecosystem recover. When you cut a slab of one of these healthy soils, it looks like a pincushion because the earthworms have created multiple burrows from the surface down into the soil. And that's what gives us that rapid infiltration. It's not the movement of water between soil particles, but it's the movement of water down that superhighway of an earthworm burrow from a crack that extends from the surface down into the subsoil. A lot of people in Oklahoma complain about the red clay soils. But when those red clay soils dry and crack, they create that an environment where that soil is ready to take the kind of rains that you can see in South Carolina. We've seen soils in Oklahoma absorb 8 inches of water in just a few days because the surface was in good condition and all of that clay underneath was cracked and open and took dramatic amounts of water in a short period of time. In contrast to that, tillage agriculture destroys structure, it destroys life, it creates boundaries in the soil. Soil is a vertical environment. Left to itself, soil will build a vertical environment from the surface down into the subsoil. Tillage creates horizontal boundaries in the soil that are boundaries for water and air. And essentially, I'm shooting myself in the foot. How much water did I get into the subsoil on this site? None. There's my runoff. Pretty dirty. I always ask the fifth graders, you want to drink this? They say no. When I lose this as a producer, I lose soil, I lose fertility, I lose organic matter. And you as society inherit sediment, nutrients, pesticides, whatever is in that soil comes along with it. All of that foamy stuff is some of the natural soaps that are part of that soil organic matter system that helps to break surface tension and move water through the soil. Clay, you want to do the dirty work? You want Mike?
I can do the work. Here, I'll turn it over.
So how far did the water actually get into this pan? We didn't get to show you the bottom of it anyway, and Clay's going to drop it here. flip that over and see what we get. We had an intense rain, and we've got dry soil an inch and a half below the ground. When my soil is unprotected, the force of that rain hits that soil, splashes it up, destroys the aggregate, the particles fall back down and create a crust, And as soon as that crust is created, most of the rest of the storm is a loss. And that crust forms in the first few minutes. We don't have any organic matter. We don't have any surface vegetation. And there's an issue that we don't think about very often. Even on this tillage site, the water that doesn't get very far in the ground is subject to evaporation the next day. We've got soils in Oklahoma that can rain today and have wind erosion tomorrow because it dries so fast. I need to pick on somebody. Where are you from, Amy?
California.
What part?
Sacramento.
Okay, Amy's from Sacramento. She lives in a tent. She doesn't care about insulation in her house. That a lie? My wife won't live in a tent. She wants a house that's easy to heat in the winter and easy to cool in the summer. And the microorganism community in the soil is exactly like that. Microorganism community thrives under soil that has insulation. And any residue or standing vegetation is simply insulation. Some of the most modern research coming out of Lubbock shows that the yield of cotton is increased by about 20% just by having insulation on the soil that decreases the daily variability, and now we can actually measure the change in biomass of the bacteria and the fungus just because we lower the daily temperature range. If you want an analogy from me, everybody in here likes 98.6. Microorganisms thrive in a constant temperature, and any system that introduces insulation onto the surface keeps that soil within biologically active temperature ranges on a year-round basis. Not to mention the fact that any insulation cuts down that hidden loss of evaporation that we tend to forget about it. A friend of ours came from South Dakota named Dwayne Beck. If you're not familiar with him, you need to be familiar with him. He made some people mad because one year his whole talk was take the E out of ET. We were taught that evapotranspiration was part of the natural system. Well, why should I waste money on evaporation? I'd rather use my water to grow a plant with. And I can take the evaporation out of these systems by keeping more insulation on the top. In Oklahoma, the biggest problem we fight is soil loss, water loss, because we've got hot soils and high evaporation. If I want a system that's more resilient and can adapt to more climatic extremes, I want a system that can make the most efficient use of the water that I get. The way I do that is plant diversity, soil stability, keeping it green on a year-round basis. What's my fourth point? Keep it green, keep it stable, keep it diverse, keep it cool. And livestock are important because all of this country developed or evolved under livestock grazing. I had one last point that I can't forget. I also can't remember it. Yes, sir.
Last point, livestock, but what kind of grazing is optimal?
The question is, what kind of grazing is optimal? And the stock answer is grazing that mimics nature. So in this environment, we had bison, elk, antelope, deer, and a whole host of little bitty critters. The optimal system would strive for that balance that nature had. We see a lot of people combining cattle with goats, with sheep, with deer. Not everybody can do that. But yesterday I drove down the road and we're seeing more wildlife at my house than we've ever seen because we're in a system where we do the managed grazing. And what that means is you take your cattle, put them in a small spot, eat a whole lot quick, and then give it a rest for as long as you can. And Kim said that they graze one day and rest for 364. We graze a couple of weeks and rest for 8 or 10 or 12 weeks. But the point is that physiologically grass, you can take a big harvest and then give it a rest, and physiologically it responds and grows. But if you walk by and take a bite of it every week, it weakens it, and it finally dies. So, no, my wife won't let me have goats. But Nat deer will take part of that grazing in that system. So any system that can bring a balance in is going to be best. But a lot of people can only do cattle. Some people only want to do bison. But the point is to work with the physiology of the grass rather than to fight it. In this country, 200 years ago, a herd of bison would move in and eat, trample, and poop on everything and then leave for 6 months. And so the system we had was a highly productive system because of the way that we harvested. You have to have the animals in that harvest system, and they work as part of the, as a herbivore, they take this carbon, process some of it, and then set a lot of it back on the ground with a whole bunch of microorganisms. So they're part of the way that system works and that microorganism system works. Questions?
Yeah, there's very... Amy Quinton with Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. There's very few farmers that do no-till in California, and I hear a lot of different excuses, but one of the main ones I hear is because they have high-value vegetable crops, and I'm wondering if there is a problem or challenges with doing no-till in vegetable crops.
Amy asked the question about which I know the least. Okay. We are seeing Oklahoma small farmers make those changes to vegetable crops and truck crops and garden crops. Producers in California argue that they are still predominantly row irrigated, where they run water down a row, and all this residue holds back water, makes that difficult. They use a lot of hand labor. Virginia is one of the states that has the least amount of no-till. On the other end of the continent, Virginia and Maryland have the highest percentage of no-till. The land that Washington and Jefferson farmed and destroyed has been brought back to health, and we've seen that in the Potomac River Valley. It's difficult to unlearn the lessons of the last 300 years. And in a system that looks this radically different and requires a lot more management between the ears, it can be very hard to change in those crops that are a lot of hand labor, use that kind of irrigation, and I don't have an answer for that yet.
And one of the things, too, Greg mentioned about unlearning lessons of the past, when you look at the no-till system and compare it to the native system, we know now by experiment, by research, that it's a better way to farm, but it's counterintuitive. I'm a natural resource consultant, but I also farm with my brother and my nephew, and I grew up disking a lot of ground. And that's what we were always taught. You need to open up the ground so that it can take in a rain. You've got to prepare that seed bed. The weeds are growing in the summer in competition with your wheat. They're going to suck out all the moisture. You got to work up that ground so you can take in a rain, have it bare, have it ready to plant that seed. Well, there's your disc ground. That's how much water it took in. And there's the topsoil that's the basis of my wealth that's now in a river and a lake. And it's what people at the end, when you're talking about water quality problems, 90% of your water quality problems are tied to that soil particle. If you can hold that soil in place, it not only helps the producer, but it helps the folks downstream. And Greg?
Well, here's some of this soil from this no-till field. One of the objections has been that, well, the soil is hard. The root's going to feel compaction. But in fact, this soil is about 60% airspace. It's only about 40% solid matter. That solid matter is glued together into aggregates between the glue from the fungus, the glomalin, that's the name of that little glue, earthworms, all kinds of microorganisms rebuild this environment. And even if this soil feels hard to me, it's actually just a stiff, stable sponge. And when that root germinates, it doesn't feel any compaction, it doesn't feel any restriction. As soon as this soil is moist, it grows with a real rapidity that surprises us. My friend sent me a picture last week, and he had a group of wheat plants from two different parts of his field. It was all no-till, but the group on the left was smaller, it had lower mass, less root mass, already had insect damage, and the group of plants on the right had more wheat, more root mass, larger plants, more density, and the difference was the healthier plants grew where he had a cover crop already growing and established. And what we know is that as soon as I plant a new seed going into the fall, that fungal ecosystem transfers its activity from the crop that's maturing into the crop that's just being germinated, and you carry on that movement of carbon throughout the system into the winter. One point we might make is that everybody has a different definition for carbon sequestration. What I want to do is to get carbon out of the air and entrain it as living and dead organic matter in the soil and rebuild that system so that it's capable of harvesting the sunlight and making as much production as possible. If we take that soil that we dumped out and go from 1% back to 3% organic matter, we're going to store about 2 tons of nitrogen as organic fertilizer as part of that organic matter that makes up, it's the protein that makes up that organic matter. If we raise the content of that soil by 2%, on a half section of land, 320 acres, it'd be equivalent amount of carbon as in a coal train. There's a tremendous potential for the storage of carbon in the soil, but we don't merely want to store it. We want to get it back in that train of life to where it can function and participate in these ecosystem services. I guess the point that I was trying to get to is that when we can rebuild the ecosystem, either in cropland or in rangeland, farming or grazing systems, then we reestablish the ecosystem function that has benefits. Clay made this up. He said bundled benefits. If I rebuild my system to function in a healthy manner like one of these pans on the end, I benefit as a producer because I grow more grass and raise more beef and sell more hamburgers. But society benefits immediately in clean air. If all I do is quit stirring up dust, then immediately you get clean air. As soon as I take this water and get it into the soil, store it, clean it, and send it downstream in a controlled, clean flow, then society's benefits are that you don't pay to clean up water that I sent to you dirty. You get water throughout the year. We don't have floods, or don't have as bad a flood. You can always still get a flood, but the normal runoff that we get on about a year and a half return, we have accepted for years that that dirty water was normal. And so for years, we've been putting up with this loss. One last little point. I got to thinking about my Bermuda grass. This is some land that we revegetated about 8 years ago. We originally sprigged Bermuda grass, and since then, we've allowed the weeds to come in. We've allowed the forbs to come in. We've added several different legumes into this mix to help build the diversity. That pan had a little bit of runoff, but we've used this for about a week, so this makes about 12 inches of rain that I've put on this pan in a week. The kind of storms that we had in Carolina this week have a return interval for Oklahoma of about every 1,000 to 4,000 years. It's our lifetimes that make us think that those extreme events are once-in-a-lifetime deal, and they might be for us, but they're normal extreme ends of the environment for the Great Plains too. And if our soils can process and deal with higher amounts of rainfall, then we're going to ameliorate some of that damage from these extreme events.
And just to kind of add to that, the adaptation that's provided production agriculture by changing these practices, I think, speaks for itself. I mean, at the end of the day, we do have to feed 9 billion people by mid-century. But we're going to be doing it in a much more extreme situation, much more variable weather patterns, a changing climate that, quite frankly, is going to present all kinds of challenges moving forward. This gives agriculture producers the tools they need to adapt to those extreme events. At the same time, Greg said about putting the carbon back into the system. As I mentioned before, you can sequester that carbon in the soil, pull that CO2 out of the atmosphere, and get it back into that natural cycle again, get it back where it belongs, and have it where, again, it's not a challenge that we have that's causing the problems that we see with the greenhouse effect and climate change, but actually get it back into the natural carbon cycle where it needs to be to help us to provide that food and fiber. Shannon had talked about water quality. One thing I might add is that our water quality success stories in Oklahoma actually is dovetailed with the carbon sequestration program. So some of you were in some of the other presentations earlier. There's actually been as much as 50,000 acres signed up in Oklahoma in a carbon sequestration program where producers who are undertaking these practices to help address water quality, to help control erosion, to help return organic matter to the soil, quite frankly, to help their own bottom lines, are also helping take CO2 out of the atmosphere. It's been estimated almost as many as 8,000 cars. The equivalent of taking 8,000 cars off the road was done through the amount of carbon that was sequestered, and that doesn't count the emissions that were avoided. So there's some great success stories out there. With that, let's get to questions.
Hi, I'm Rona Cobell. I'm a reporter with the Chesapeake Bay Journal. So I'm from the magical land of no-till. And my question is, I guess I have two questions. One, how long does it take for a farm that's been in traditional conservation, regular disking, how long does it take for them to be sold on the benefits of no-till? How long does that land have to be in no-till before they see the benefits? And my second question is, I understand from talking to the Oklahomans that my region gets a lot of money for these conservation practices and that you guys don't get that much money. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that works.
We've done this show in the Chesapeake Bay area and had folks with the initiative see this same demonstration using soils from the Potomac Valley. First off, how long does it take to see benefits? An economist says that's always an it depends question. This year, the typical answer is 3 to 5 years. But this year we saw a producer that harvested wheat and established a grazing crop of 13 different species, and 60 days later, the changes that we already see in the soil are dramatic. Because when you put that many different species into a field that's been essentially impoverished, you get an immediate physiological reaction. They planted everything from turnips and okra to prosow millet and hay grazer sorghum. So the intensity with which you manage makes the difference in how fast the system responds. We originally thought that when somebody went to no-till and still only grew one or two crops, we were looking at a 5 to 10 year window to where they saw that improvement. But when somebody goes to no-till and immediately diversifies their cropping system and then begins to either add companion crops or cover crops, that window of improvement time is drastically shortened. We see some real improvement in just a few years. I'm going to say that...
You said you had a 60-day change. What kind of change did you see? Can you quantify that?
When we went into this field that had harvested wheat, and then the landowner planted a 13-way mix that included grasses, legumes, and forbs. The forbs were purple-top turnips, grazing radishes, grazing turnips, okra. He planted cowpeas, mung beans, prosow millet, grazing corn, sorghum Sudan grass. And when we dug into that soil, the root mass, the amount of earthworms that immediately had come back, the little fruiting bodies from the fungal bodies that had already showed back up, in all honesty, I can't explain the dramatic differences that we see in cropland when people go to a highly diverse mix of plants. And these guys that plant these mixes spend $25 to $30 an acre for seed, and then they get 45 days of high quality grazing at the end of the summer to and so they make their money back on the grazing plus the nitrogen that the legumes put in the soil while they're there growing. And I was surprised. So I drive up on my friend Jimmy, and him and a guy are sitting in a pickup watching cows eat. And, you know, they go up there and they smell that plant, and then they take a bite. And he looked at me. He said, "I'm sorry." He said, "This shit just won't work, will it?" He's into his third year of successful money-making late summer grazing with crops that are very diverse. And then at the end of the grazing period, he plants wheat right back into that standing cover. And then in the winter, his cattle go back and graze the wheat and eat the standing cover for hay. We can't explain that physiologically. I can't anyway, but I can't deny the results. And he started in the middle of the drought. He didn't start in the good weather. He started in the dry weather. But that canopy, if you've got a canopy of grass this tall, the humidity inside that canopy is quite high, and the temperature is lower. And I can conceive how I capture sunlight today. The only money I can make is on sunlight that I capture. I capture sunlight today. I make some sugar tonight. I pump that sugar down to the roots. The roots grow, and some of that sugar gets exuded into the soil, and some of that root mass is eaten. And within a day or two, we're seeing carbon taken out of the soil, put through the plant. Some of it's going to be back into the air in that canopy in a day or two and captured again, because in that canopy, the wind speed is low. You're capturing high humidity. We're changing the way these systems work because we're starting to understand how important all of this stuff is on top. Bare fields, well, how would you like it, Ryan, if we didn't feed you for 3 months? These bare fields that are bare from June to October, essentially, we're killing everybody that lives there for 4 months and then hoping that they'll come back and support our plants when we plant a wheat crop. The research on cotton in Lubbock shows that those underground ecosystems and that fungus immediately transfers function from wheat and rye to cotton in the spring and then back again in the fall. So we really are learning that we've got a system that doesn't respond anything like we expected it to.
I think I was next.
I've already asked your question.
So one question I have, and we've talked a lot about this conference about communication, how do you, as an Oklahoman, communicate climate change to an audience in Oklahoma, especially agriculturalists in the state, who are probably not necessarily, maybe they believe in climate change as a phenomenon, but not that it's anthropogenic, that it's human-induced. So how do you communicate that? Because you've communicated that very well to us. Or do you just say, well, this is about soil health and fertility of my crops, and we're not even going to touch that crazy political stuff? I'm just interested in that end of things.
How do we deal with the climate change question? My comment is that I don't care who causes it. I want to recreate an agricultural system that is stable to environmental extremes. And those extremes can be mankind caused or caused as part of the natural system. But in 1934, a guy named Thornwaite wrote a chapter in a book, and he said, mankind has always been badly fooled by semi-arid land. And we are in a semi-arid land. The climate here over the last 2,000 years has been so extreme, been at least 5 scientifically proved influxes of humans into and out of the Great Plains based on occupation patterns and archaeological work that's been done in Oklahoma. We know that weather similar to what has occurred in North Carolina does occur in Oklahoma. And we have multiple streams of scientific disciplines that give us the same results and the same datings, whether it's soil science or archaeology or or dendrology, we get the same answers that line up to say that this environment is extreme in lengths of time that exceed human, you know, populations. My own work was on how sand dunes develop, and we can date the development and destruction of sand dunes back over the last 10,000 years. We get extremely wet, we get extremely dry, and yet the generation of scientists just older than me said, no, it doesn't ever change, this is the way it's always been. And they discounted the observations of scientists throughout the 1800s, and yet the droughts of the 1800s were much worse than anything we experienced in the 20th century. And it was documented by explorers and scientists in the 1820s and 1850s. And if you look up the history of Kansas, in 1850, 90% of the people in Kansas went back east.
That's just because it was Kansas.
It could have been. People were going back east, and they were shipping hay from Tennessee to the remaining livestock in Kansas. So we live in a situation that, regardless of our input, requires us to abandon a system that was guaranteed to fail under any conditions and move to a system that's sustainable. Now, there also is the idea that if I can increase carbon in my soil, there's only one place that I can get carbon to put in my soil. And that one place is carbon dioxide that's in the air. Soil is already the largest store of carbon in the world, of organic carbon, but I only get rain and sun and CO2 for free. I need to be harvesting that as much as possible and keep as much as possible in my soil to keep that ecosystem functioning. So that's how I talk about it. I don't know who caused it, and I don't care.
We have 10 minutes left.
Will, and I might add real quick, that's what's so exciting about this. Is because so many times when you talk about issues like environmental protection and production agriculture, there's a tendency for some folks to want to obviously automatically make them adversarial. That's not the case. And you have the opportunity, at least when you're talking about soil health and improving the health of the soil, to at least for a little while have folks in production agriculture and those folks who are interested in environmental protection come around the fire and sing kumbaya. Because at the end of the day, if I want agriculture to help mitigate climate change, if I want to help address the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, in this part of the world, what do I want producers to do? Convert to no-till, incorporate cover crops, do better pasture management, take highly erodible land out of grass, out of crop production, put it back to grass, restore riparian areas. What do I want to do? Yeah, that's what I want to do to mitigate greenhouse gases. What do I want to do to help them to adapt to the extreme of climate change? Convert to no-till, cooperate cover crops, take highly erodible land out of grass or out of production, put it back into grass, do better pasture management. What do I want to do to help address non-point source pollution? Convert to no-till, incorporate cover crops, plant highly erodible land back to grass. Do these things, these same practices, regardless of what's the issue that trips the trigger of the producer to undertake it. You know, regardless, we're getting benefits out of it. One of the examples I always use is that the doctor, if I go to the doctor tomorrow and the doctor says, Clay, you're getting fat. And if you don't lose weight, you're going to have a heart attack and die. And I like chicken fried steak and I like cold beer. And I'm just like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. But then I go home. Sarah meets me at the door and says, damn it, Clay, you're getting fat and I don't like the way you look. Now, that's important to me that my wife is happy. So I'm going to lose weight. But you know what? I'm also not going to have a heart attack because I lost weight. Who cares what the motivation is? The bottom line is, if we can undertake systems that mimic nature, if we can do things that do what we're talking about here, everybody wins. And regardless of what pushes people forward, even folks who don't believe in climate change, I'll guarantee you they believe in droughts and floods. And that's the key. These are the same tools that we need to harden our system to extreme weather events like droughts and floods, but they're also the same things that we need to do to help mitigate some of the effects of climate change, or some of the causes of climate change.
A water news agency. Greg, you said that it takes 300 years to it takes a long time to unlearn the lessons of 300 years, but I'm wondering, here in an hour, you've taught a pretty good lesson that I think is pretty convincing. So is unlearning it more a matter of investments that have already been made, economic incentives, policies? What is the unlearning that needs to be done?
He asked a tough question. I've got a farm and I raise cow-calf. A cow-calf operation is where you have a bull and some cows and you sell the calves into the system. And I've got to admit that it's a lot easier to know the right things than to do the right things. It's easier for me not to manage and go around and play like this than it is to think through my operation and go out and take the actions that I need to take. Even when they're simple, there's something in human nature that it's hard to change the direction you're going. And it takes a few pioneers, and this is our conservation paradigm that's worked for nearly 100 years, a few pioneers in a community that'll make a change are the examples for their neighbors who follow them and see that they're happier, they're more profitable, they got a new house, their wife is happy. Literally, those producers that are pioneers, we discover that their neighbors will incorporate their ideas, and it's the same idea of pioneers and early adopters that of all new systems. In the ag community, it seems to be slower, but we interviewed one of our House representative guys this spring, and he's tickled to death with his no-till farming. I said, "Where'd you get that idea?" He said, "I got it from my neighbor, Jimmy Kinder, who is a pioneer and generally regarded as an idiot. He knows more about cattle than I'll ever know in my life. He's been raising cattle since he was 10 years old, and most of our pioneers are degraded because they're willing to take chances and make changes. But then their neighbors see that, and they adopt. And so slowly, it moves through the community, educationally, person to person, and as an individual gets tired of the old way and finally believes that what his neighbor can do in the new way will work.
So how many farmers, ranchers, you know, growers are going to no-till and seeing these kinds of benefits, and how many are tilling or doing the modified till situation? How far do you have to go to bring them over to no-till?
It depends on your state, depends on your culture. In Oklahoma, about 35% of our acres are no-till, and that varies year to year. We would like to see that. My vision for the future is to look across Oklahoma and not see any bare ground. Soil that's bare is dying. There's even climatic implications we won't have time to talk about from bare soil, heat exchange, and albedo. But if you go to Virginia and Maryland and the East Coast, over 90% no-till.
Last question, anybody?
Ryan Brown, North Bay, Texas. I think I know the answer to this, but there seems to be a tremendous amount of benefit doing a whole lot more with less. What are the tractor dealers, the manufacturers, they see this or they know about this, what are they changing in their manufacturing processes to benefit this, expedite, the process, anything like that?
I think there's a lot of interest on the part of equipment manufacturers because of the fact you are, especially in this part of the world, in virgin territory. You know, and you think about the challenges to getting people to adopt a no-till, especially in the southern plains, because the values of our crops are less than you see in places like Indiana and Iowa. Winter wheat, you know, our production, if we get a 40 bushel wheat crop, that's a heck of a wheat crop, you know, compared to even in Kansas where you're seeing 110, 120. We're on the margin in this part of the world. So the cost of equipment is a major challenge. Now, if you can get people to make that purchase of that equipment, that's a lot of new money that implement dealer is going to have running through their pocket. And like with any other piece of equipment, you've got to have maintenance on it. You've got to do those things. But when you look at some of the challenges that we're seeing in adoption of no-till, cost of equipment is a big challenge, quite frankly. My family converted to no-till about 13 years ago. And at that time, to buy a sprayer and to buy a drill, it was in the neighborhood of about $130,000. And when you've got equipment already set up to farm a certain way, it's a big cost challenge to go ahead and make a switch. And then the fact when your producers have an average age of over 65, you know, between 60 and 65 is the average age of your agriculture producer. If he's sitting there thinking, now I'm set up to farm this way, I'm probably only going to farm another 20 years if I'm lucky. Am I going to go ahead and make $130,000, you know, investment in something that, you know, I'm only going to be doing with for just a couple of decades? That's a challenge. And then on top of that, you have cultural issues. You know, my dad passed away in February, and he was all in on no-till. Now, quite frankly, we probably wouldn't have switched when we switched if our equipment hadn't been wore out and we had to make an investment. And my brother and I were there wanting to farm as well, and he knew there was going to be generations farming past him, and he wanted to make that investment. And he educated himself and understood the benefits. But to the day he died, he would drive past and he'd see our no-till field and he'd see the conventional tilled field down here, and he'll say, man, that just looks better. Because that's the way he was grown. That was the way he was raised. That's the way you're supposed to farm. So you have those cultural challenges that go along with that. And there's some misconceptions and just learning. Because a lot of this stuff, talking about the microbial community under the soil, 3 decades ago, we didn't even know it existed. I mean, we're just now learning things that are helping us to understand where we're at. So that's some of the things that we see. You would need a no-till drill, either a mechanical drill or an air seeder, and then a sprayer, and that's it. That's one of the benefits on the reduction in diesel use. I mean, I mentioned the 3 gallons of diesel less per acre per year, because you're only doing, you know, and that's without cover crops. You know, you're talking a couple burn downs a year with herbicide and then planting your wheat. Now, with cover crops, you can reduce that even more. Now, granted, you have another pass where you're planting your cover crops that you're drilling, but there's some good evidence that that as you manage cover crops correctly, you can reduce the amount of times that you have to hit with herbicide. In fact, I believe Alan Miniman down in southwest Oklahoma said there's been times that he's gone 2 or 3 years without ever having to apply herbicide because livestock and the cover crops have managed the weed for him when he goes back into his winter wheat crop. So, I mean, it opens up some great opportunities as far as reducing the amount of time and the input costs that go into agriculture. But when you stop and think about it, there's still going to be plenty of inputs that your machine dealers and your other service providers are going to have plenty of things to sell us in the marketplace.
No, I don't see that.
In 1985, CRP was a program that took land out of production, and we saw agricultural businesses collapse in communities that lost so much land out of production. Right now, we're seeing equipment people change their lines and adapt to that change, just like the buggy whip thing. But we're also have the potential for a long-lasting agriculture that's sustainable, where we don't continually take marginal land out of production, but we restore it and use it in a productive way. So a friend of mine that's a soil scientist, he quit working for the government and immediately went to working for a no-till equipment producer, a manufacturer. So the manufacturing opportunities are exploding. But it takes more engineering and generally more cost. But one grandpa that I know in Kansas, he said when we switched to no-till, we saved 12,000 gallons of diesel per year. Now that was at $1. But at $4, he said, plus we don't do maintenance on all of our tillage equipment, we quit using. So even though the new equipment is expensive, you don't have 3 or 4 or 5 different pieces of other equipment that you need to maintain, discs and chisels and bearings and what have you.
So, okay, I got to call it real quick. I don't know how much time these guys have left. They've got another presentation this afternoon. Let's thank Greg, Shannon, and Clay for the presentation.
We also have some information over here if you guys would like on some of the stuff.